that, but we've learnt from bitter experience that this is probably the best way to approach something with this number of participants. We're wanting to have a Q&A at the end, so anyone who wants to make a comment or contribute a question or anything, please put it in the chat, and Nora will be curating that as we proceed. We're recording this session, and it will be available on the WASE website and probably on your own National Association website next week, or a link to it. So check back on the WASE website next week if you'd like to share this session with your colleagues. If at any stage we lose transmission or something happens and freezes or something, the suggestions that we've got are that you either mute, take your video off, or you leave the session and re-enter it. That's the suggestions we've got. We just hope that it all holds. So let's start the session. So the top days, what's the success, strategies and impacts on integrated education and COVID-19? Clearly, we're all in unprecedented times globally after the pandemic. Obviously, in my home, as many of you are, I'm in as well. So this has had huge impacts on our work life, our personal life, and significant impacts on tertiary education generally around the globe. Today, we want to focus on impacts on integrated learning, corporate education, and as many workplaces moved online, this caused a whole range of disruptions that have impacted our practice, and which has meant that for many of us, there have been some rapid pivots that have happened to accommodate this pandemic. So today, we're going to hear from these four leaders about what's been happening in their countries, and I'll just introduce the four of them immediately, and then we'll go to the panel. We've got Jenny Fleming from newly named New Zealand, which you think is New Zealand. We have Tara Chick, from is President of Single, and you can wave so people on the screen. We've got Vincent Trudeau, who is President of ACED Australia, and we have Dawn Pellitz, who is President of CA in the United States of America. And they're all joining us, and we're very grateful to have their leadership for their times and their insights. So let's start with some questions. So we'll ask Jenny Pax first. Jenny, we might get you to outline some of the working in New Zealand, and what are the strategies that have been put in place to respond to these challenges?
Right, kia ora everyone. New Zealand's probably in a little different situation from many around the world. We're only a country of 5 million, and we are an island nation. Therefore, when we came to our responses to COVID-19, we looked at trying to protect our country as much as we could. So on the 25th of March, with some government directives, the whole country went into a complete lockdown. Now, it was a much harsher, stricter lockdown than most other countries in the world. In the lockdown, the only businesses that could operate were hospitals and supermarkets and essential services. No other businesses could have face-to-face or any type of contact with other people. New Zealanders lived in a bubble within their own home, and the only activity they could undertake was walking in their local community. All other sporting activities, all other social activities, everything was absolutely shut down. So it was a really, really severe situation, and it happened very quickly over 2 or 3 days from people just working normally to the whole country shut down. So that created huge challenges for most businesses. With every business closed, all our work-integrated learning placements were thrown up in the air. There was huge uncertainty. The universities were closed. Businesses were struggling in a very short space of time to try and work some form of remote activities. Many businesses just not at all. It didn't happen. Every cafe, restaurant, tourism, everything was closed. Even McDonald's was closed. So there was a lot of tension, there was a lot of nervousness, and it really did create uncertainty. But over a week or two, and people got used to being in a little bubble at home, lots of innovative ideas and strategies started to be created. Businesses started thinking a little bit laterally. Our Will students and many of their businesses had great opportunities to actually observe what was happening in a remote environment when things had to change significantly in the way that the whole country operated. So some really innovative practices started to occur. Now, my experience is in sport, and we had students on placement involved in running virtual yoga classes, developing programs for athletes to maintain their activities and things at home. We had students working in organisations that were contributing to thinking how an event management business could run. So from Dire Straits perspective, there were lots of opportunities for our students created in that virtual remote working environment. But that wasn't for all. So all our hospitality, all our tourism, everything just put totally on hold. And we were in lockdown for a whole 5 weeks where we couldn't move outside our bubble of our family home. But once schools started opening 5 weeks later with online learning, once businesses started to have takeaway coffees, there were more opportunities sort of starting to be created for the ways that students can get involved. University went back after 5 weeks, but only in an online way. And our Will students then were looking for ways to restart their placements, to think about how we might come up with alternative assessments and ways of doing things to cope with the fact that still businesses were not able to operate in the normal way. So it created lots of opportunities, lots of uncertainty, and a whole lot of challenges that came out of it. Now, I know later on we're going to talk about specific strategies, so I will leave that at that point and just mention we're now at what's called alert level 2, where finally businesses have been able to open at last, and with social distancing and lots of requirements to enable us to keep safe. We only have now 21 cases active in New Zealand and no one in hospital. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Jenny. Maybe we could move over to Canada. Cara, would you like to share the impacts and perhaps some of the strategies?
Sure. So it's 9 o'clock and in the evening, and I'm just outside of Niagara Falls, which most people, it's the landmark I refer to. So welcome. Thank you for having me from Niagara in Canada. It's been a really interesting, as you know, 2 months, but I think that it's been about 800 COVID years is what it feels like. I think back what happened, very similar to what happened in Canada. I think that we saw those province and territory, because of the size of the country, was dealing with their own state's emergency and was closing down at different times. So that was interesting to see if we all kind of reflect back on the experience we were having. But no matter where that was happening, we started to hear about how students were being impacted, and obviously universities, colleges, institutions, and our employers and communities. So I think back to Friday the 13th, when we received a phone call from one of our large employer partners and said they were thinking about canceling all their summer co-op returns. And that was one of those moments that we had to just listen and come up with some really quick strategies, but also realize the impact this could have on us. So very quickly, our board got together. We passed a motion to recommend that put a statement out recommending a couple of things, which was, first of all, to not cancel students, give them an opportunity to have students work from home if they could, if they needed to, move their start date from May 1st to June 1st, and as well, that our accreditation guidelines will be flexible during this period so people didn't feel like the accreditation would be at risk if they had new positions because of what was happening in COVID. So that came out really quickly, just right before kind of the waves were hitting us quite hard, and that position seemed really well within the country. We were being quoted in places we've never been quoted before, and it really was helpful just to provide some direction to a variety of employers, community partners, and institutions from across the country. The other thing that happened very quickly because of this is we started hosting calls. And so welcome to my Canadian colleagues, if you may be used to seeing here. It's usually at 1 o'clock on Mondays, 9 o'clock, so it's the evening edition. But we started doing that really quickly. At first we were doing twice a week, and then we realized it was a bit too much. And just the amount of information that was coming at us and to be able to share information. So we started hosting weekly town halls, and they were something that we started with maybe 40, 50 people, went to 80, some had over 200 people on the call. And the other thing we started to realize was that through these calls, the amount of information that was required. So we needed to understand the impact of what was actually happening, not just from a perspective of we knew anecdotally, but we decided that we would start doing some pulse data. And we also knew the data was going to be very stagnant very quickly. So with the help of Janine Pretty through Walkies of Waterloo, we started to do some pulse surveying of the Will community. And one of the other things that we did was we opened up Seawell to anybody. You didn't have to be a member, was anybody of the Will community, and we started to see a very large increase there. But what that also helped us do was to get the data from as many people as possible. So as of last week, we collected the co-op opportunities specifically. We're down to 23% across the country. We also started to recognize that college system in Canada was being hit much harder than the university system because of hands-on learning that was happening there. And we started to see some differences in our provinces and territories depending on how many employers they had, large businesses, those types of things. We saw just over 6,000 opportunities canceled. This was reporting from about 40 institutions from across the country. So again, just really trying to take a pulse every 2 weeks over a period of 6 weeks, and we're going out with our next round of data shortly. And we'll start including other data points that we're trying to look at, like how on-campus recruitment in the fall is going to be affected, and which will be in September for us in Canada. So those are kind of the impacts. We also, the Canadian government just surveyed about 100,000 students with crowdsourcing data, and with that, the students were saying 35% of them had either postponed or canceled or integrated an opportunity. So our data was quite aligned with what the students were saying, and we're just working on getting that information in a press release for the next couple of days. Strategy-wise, I would say that we moved so quickly that a lot of our strategies were what we needed to do in the moment. So like I said, we opened up our membership to the entire Well community. We developed resources. So we were really trying to push this concept of allowing students to work from home. So we developed resources, and they've been shared across the country and across the world. We've seen them pop up on Twitter around supporting students who work remotely, onboarding students remotely, those types of things. We just recently, yesterday, sent out virtual career fair and how to run virtual career fairs. So we started developing those resources. And also advocating government. So that's been a big thing in Canada. There was an announcement a couple years ago now. There's $800 million investment into working together learning specifically. And we worked really closely with the government to figure out how they need to work for us in this time. So there's flexibility measures announced by government that include now institutions can hire students in Will opportunities, and that's been a really big help to help leverage some of these lost opportunities for students. So we're just going to see the results of that. And I would say everything else you can really find on our website. I don't take any more time, but we have a COVID-19 resource section on our website that has all of our resources, any statements that we have, and a couple of these will see some ideas as well. And we develop some tools. I think really we just figured out how to align, how to adjust, and continue to advocate for students working together across the country.
Thank you, Cara. I'm now going to Sydney, Francisco Trey from ICN Australia.
Thank you, Julie, and welcome everybody. I'm sitting in my daughter's bedroom, which I've converted into my study. In Sydney, it's a sunny day, and it's a good time, 11:20 in the morning. And in Australia, almost like in New Zealand and Canada, COVID hit really, really suddenly in terms of government making drastic decisions of distancing measures. And you have to think about this. It happened sort of into the first week of teaching term. So students were on campus for 1 week, and then we were told, shut the campus down. Public life was shut down as well. So that was a really drastic, abrupt disruption. And we were suddenly thrown really into the future. We know in the future is we rely more on digital technology. And we suddenly had to fully rely on digital teaching. And we called it sort of remote emergency teaching. And the impact is very different to different models. There's such a diversity, as we know. There are some very highly regulated professional placements, and students cannot graduate unless they have completed certain hours in those placements for graduation. Whereas there are other courses, there's unregulated will experiences or workplace experiences, and each of them are affected slightly differently. So What we did very quickly, because we thought, my God, what's happening? What's everybody doing? We conducted a survey with our Will Network and asked, what's the impact on your students? What's the impact on your employees? And what's the impact on your institution, university, and yourselves? And the impact for employees, really, like everyone else, is uncertainty, economic uncertainty. They felt they had to first look after their employees and maybe let go of interns. And a lot of paid internships, placements have been converted to unpaid internships, because maybe in your country as well, some organizations are asking the employees to take a pay cut or a pay freeze, and they felt it was difficult to now find money to have students in their placements. For students, they were also very anxious about the uncertainty. You know, can I graduate? How can I progress? I don't want to COVID, I don't want to go on placement, or I do want to go on placement to finish off. There were issues about equity and access, because some students in one program would complete the placement, but other students in the same program couldn't. So how to accommodate that? And also connectivity to the internet is an immense issue. So equity and access was really highlighted. It's really nothing new in the real literature and our real practices. And for universities, the same thing. How do we support the students? How do we support the employers? And communication breakdowns was really a high impact to keep real programs going. Because of this uncertainty, it is actually a beautiful opportunity to become creative and to actually change the things we always wanted to change, because now the things that didn't work, they surely don't work now, and it's an opportunity to get rid of them and create new opportunities and more innovative, more for the future purposed will practice. In terms of strategies, we had really two strategies, advocacy for will at a national level, and we were invited to collaborate with the Australian Council of the Professions and all the professional accreditation bodies at University of Australia to advise the government how to move forward. And we co-wrote a joint statement of principles for higher education sector as a COVID response, and ACE made sure that professional placements featured strongly in that joint statement. We also had some press releases, and you can see them all on our website. Secondly, our second strategy really was engagement with our collaborative network. And of course, we were very pleased to see how our community came together. We are more vibrant than ever before. We organized, based on the survey results, webinars that really focused on the needs that people had. And we are conducting weekly webinars now with presenters from our network and also overseas. We have a lot of friends in New Zealand who participated, also people from Canada and UK and US. And we are providing professional development that way. We also have some informal coffee chats. We call them every Friday afternoon. They're sort of, how are you going? And they're very creative in that little space. There are not that many people, around 10 people every Friday, and different people. We brew up new ideas and we get very excited and full of energy. So that's one other strategy.
Thank you very much, Francis.
And we have a COVID web page.
Yes, and what I might do is I'll be sending out an email at the end of this, and I might put links to all the national associations that have featured today, and you can look at all those websites and put some of the resources. That's from Illinois in the USA and Dawn from CIA.
Yes, hello, greetings everyone. It's about 8:30 p.m. here. I'm about 2 hours south of Chicago, that's my hometown, and I'm with Illinois Central College, and before that I was at Bradley University, director of their cooperative education and internship program, so I'm pleased to be with you all tonight. So, for COVID, we're still very much in a stay-at-home order here. I had my first smell of Starbucks coffee today. It was the first time that a Starbucks was open in one of our grocery stores. That was kind of amazing to have that smell come back over you. We have 1.7 million cases in the U.S. of COVID and 100,000 deaths. So for us, it is almost, it never happens anymore that you're not on a meeting, phone call, taking part in something that you're not talking to a colleague that is a family member that's infected. So everyone knows someone at this point. And we're still on following our governor's orders. All the states have governor's orders. We're still in phase two lockdown, but it ends this weekend. We finally go to phase three. That's just opening up a few more essential stores. So it's just loosening up a little bit, but we're nowhere near where we need to be. They're looking at the plans for colleges and universities to open, but they're not until phase four, phase five. My boss, she's president of our college. She's on the governor's task force to look at what's going to be needed here. So I feel like all of my colleagues' discussions for the day, I mean, we're all developing and navigating reopening plans. So your energy moves to these other things, you know, and how to set up your offices with the plexiglass and with, you know, are we going to have a diagnostic testing? Are we going to have antibody testing for our students? What's the ramifications? And will we be open in the fall? Many are saying there is no way colleges and universities will be open in the fall, that it will be online. And that news is extremely devastating to the colleges. We're hearing some in the news. They're just holding. We're done, we're out. We're not going to make it just like employers, right? And so there's many colleges that are tuition-driven that go year to year on their tuition dollars. And if the students aren't enrolling, they're not going to be there. They're not going to open. They're going to close very, very quickly. So it's a real struggle to try to remain to be safe for the citizens and for the student body and figure out all these plans that have to take place to welcome students back to your campus. So that's kind of a big picture item. I think when work integrated learning back for our co-op and internship, when I think back to
the fast and furious creativity and development, innovation of all the things that had to be done. The first thing that a lot of folks were doing, students were being sent home from their placements. And so colleagues were racing to, we need to put the students to work because we're going to make up those hours that the employers are not able to do. So colleagues of mine were using things like the Harvard online classes. They're free, Coursera, trying to go to the Khan Academy and others. To give students assignments, we kind of stepped into that role of being their employer supervisor to try to keep them going on their registered experiences. Other things that have just gone crazy with our discussions are the remote internships, as we've mentioned here, but changing our thinking on remote internships. When those would come across my desk before as director of my program, I was always skeptical about approving them. I had to have a conversation, I had to find out their plan for, you know, there were so many questions that I had, and I would err on the side of not accepting them. And we are all kind of opening up our minds to virtual internships and experiences. The online platforms, the schools that didn't have their co-op internship experiences down in an online process were quickly trying to adapt. And so I know that our friends at platforms like Grad Leaders and 1220 Handshake Skill Survey, they've all been very busy. And our association has helped facilitate some of those discussions. And then another big strategy, training employers on the value of virtual internships. So we've seen our colleague, Dr. Rajnell with InternBridge. He has great resources and great training webinars for employers. And he's been very busy as well. Then our association, we're in the midst of having a wonderful, beautiful conference for 350 people in San Diego. It was supposed to be March 29th and 30th. So we had to quickly move and adjust from an in-person conference to virtually in San Diego. And we pulled off a virtual conference that was held April 9 and 10. Those resources are all on our website, and so you can see things about the different presentations. And then we have an academy that we always do to develop leaders, and we host that in Vail, Colorado every June. So we had to cancel that, and we're now doing virtual sessions June 9th and 10th. And we are tapping into that creativity that's needed. So several of the sessions are on creativity and design thinking, as we've all been in that mode, I think, as we're trying to innovate new solutions.
Thank you, Dawn. That gives us a snapshot of what's been happening in those four countries. And I think we'll now move on to perhaps a bit of a discussion. And I think, Jenny, you might want to talk also about some of your strategies, but now we might move on to what the benefits are and how you can see the future unfolding. And a reminder to people that if you've got questions that you'd like to pose to any of our four wheel leaders on the panel, then you put your question into the chat. So we'll start with Jenny. Maybe you could talk, maybe we just sort of do a little bit of thinking about the future and the sort of strategies that you think might move into the future now.
Well, many of the strategies that we've sort of put in place or identified as important in this changing climate actually create both benefits and looking at evolution to the future. So one of the first things that sort of was a strategy and also we can take forward is around innovation. Taking risks, doing things a bit more flexibly than we were used to, really thinking about how might the future of work benefit from some of these ways that we have suddenly had to throw students into different scenarios and accommodate different ways of learning. So taking innovation to the future as well. And I think I think it was Francesca that mentioned that opportunities to try things that you've always wanted to try or to get rid of some of the behaviours that you have always been stymied by in the past. So innovation is a really important strategy and a benefit. One of the things that universities in particular are trying to develop is students that are ready for an unknown future. Well, we certainly had the opportunity to prepare students to delve into a very unknown future. they were really unsure what was going to happen next week or next month or even for the rest of the year. So trying to build that resilience and those capabilities in students that we're hoping that students are, we are preparing them as university graduates to be able to cope with. So our graduate attributes, there's some different attributes that really came to the forefront when we're in these very unknown situations. And some graduate attributes I'd like to sort of highlight are self-management. Students were now at home managing either a remote work activity, trying to be creative, or managing learning online, which for us, as Francesca mentioned, they'd only been going 1 week. We'd been going 3 weeks of our semester. So they were thrown into a very, very different way of learning. Another graduate attribute became very, very important as part of the strategies of coping with will placements and changing placements was communication, leadership, networking, critical reflection, and enterprise. So if we think about those as being the benefits moving forward, they're also some of the strategies that we had to put in place for the students. So some of the sort of take-home messages was to allow flexibility and adaptability. Many of our programs across the country and were quite rigid and quite constrained about how they would approve and allow different placement opportunities. And I think it was Francesca also mentioned about some of those systems for professional accreditation and the likes. We're having to think about those differently and come up with them different ways. And examples are where students were on clinical placements in a hospital. Many hospitals were either closed all their surgical wards and those sorts of things. So students then moved into our health lines and other areas to meet the accreditation requirements. So we had to think a little bit differently and be flexible in terms of that way.
Jenny, I think, I'm just wondering, we've got a few questions. I'm just wondering whether we could now get a couple of comments from the others and other questions, which
okay,
I think...
I've just got one more...
Yeah. Right, good, great.
One more thing to go through would be encouraging emotional connection, not physical connection.
Yeah.
I think that is probably a real take home that's come out of these opportunities. Cool.
Thank you, that's fantastic. And maybe some quick reflections about the future and the benefits from Cara and Francesca and Dawn, and then we've got a number of questions, so we'll go to the questions after that. Cara.
So I agree wholeheartedly with Jenny and what she has said. So I'm not going to repeat those. I think that we have experienced similar things and lots of heads nodding as she was speaking. So I think the one thing that maybe I'll bring up so that we can get to questions is a sense of community. I had a bit of as I was thinking about this question, I was thinking about Will itself, but then I consulted with Christine and Andrew Sewell as well, those that know them, and we just kind of had a bit of a dialogue about this before. And what one of the benefits was the Will community coming together. We are in the midst of developing a Canadian charter over integrated learning to align with the WAIS charter. And we're in the midst of this, doing this work, and COVID hit. And part of the charter was to bring together the Canadian Will ecosystem. And COVID did that, not just on the national level, but again, on the global level, if you look at what we're doing right now. So I think that what it did was Sewell was really well positioned because of years of building on years of leadership and experience that we have. But also on top of that, this hit us in the middle of Will Month. We were celebrating our first National Will Month. And so we had just launched our Quality Council. We had just launched our Resource Hub. And so this kind of hit us. We were really well positioned for lots of reasons. But Sewell itself as a national association has benefited, I think, from just being able to be that place that anybody that has a touch point with Will has been able to come and the joint advocacy again. And I think that that's a benefit that we'll see going forward and continue to. Even just hearing on this, how similarly, it doesn't matter what country you're in, how similar the experience has been, and how innovation and flexibility and looking at it from a design thinking or strategically or just reacting to what's in front of you and makes sense. So I think that some of that is benefits. We kind of have to think about not being tone deaf and making sure that we're reacting and acting in a way that is aligned with what our communities need and what the Will community needs. And I think the last thing is the sharing resources that goes along with that. There's been some amazing resources that have come out of this as people innovate and want to share. So I think that it's all for the collective. I'm sure others will mention things that we all agree upon. So I'll pass it over to the next person.
Thank you, Francesca.
Wonderful, Cara. That's really amazing, the strategies and benefits and the future, how you're seeing it. I just want to add maybe two things. I think we should use this opportunity
to reconsider the purpose of will and how we educate future professionals, and that we want to educate them for the public good, and that we should consider volunteering work and service learning and get that for credit, and what they can do now to help people so nobody is left behind. I think this is something to revisioning or reaffirming maybe the purpose of will to educate future citizens as well as professionals. The other thing is the thing of virtual and online and remote simulation kind of will experiences. I think we should really reconsider the time and the space or place where students can experience work integrated learning, but not only experience it, but how do we better prepare them for the unpreparable and this uncertainty? You know, in will, we've always worked with uncertain futures because we can never foolproof, you know, we can never say you're prepared, you will do great in your placement. So we should just keep going in preparing them for what we cannot prepare students for, and then really bolster the reflection and learning for future actions. And finally, I saw in the chat something by Jackson from Melbourne, and this is a really great idea. How about we create will projects that are interdisciplinary, inter-university and global, because this pandemic has shown the complexity that we have to deal with in the future. Future work will be complex. One profession cannot solve the problems, and the future is interdisciplinary global projects. And here we are from all around the world. Why don't we dream up some projects and get our students connected around the globe?
So thank you. That's a great idea. We'll work on that one. That's a great one. Dawn, some last reflections from you, and then we'll go to Nora, who'll do the Q&A.
I agree with all of these comments. I guess the one thing that I want to add is just the idea that remote work is feasible, and that organizations and colleges and universities are now seeing just how feasible it is from an equity perspective, how allowing an individual to work from home while they're managing childcare, taking care of their family, things, you know, that can be so important for someone to get ahead in individual growth. And so I think that we're going to see a whole new movement of organizations and colleges and universities considering these at-home roles, the remote work versus all in-person in the office. And I think that would be a good thing for us.
Fabulous. We're now going to hand over to Nora McCrae from the University of Waterloo to manage the Q&A.
Great, thanks very much, and thank you to all the presenters tonight. Great insights and lots of interesting similarities across the globe as well, which is not unexpected, I imagine. Okay, a couple of questions. The first one's coming in from Canada. How are people supporting faculty to transition to remote community service learning or project-based community service learning, entrepreneurship, applied research, those kinds of things? So supporting faculty to transition to these forms of will. Any comments, any of the presenters? Kara?
I just quickly, I posted a link that's from my own institution that we just launched. There's actually a news story going about it tomorrow around, it's in our faculty handbook on experiential to transitioning online. But it brings me to more so to talk about the CWIL Resource Hub and how the Quality Council is looking for these opportunities to showcase how people are doing these things. So we're looking to curate the best practices from across the country to have them there, and there will be a call out for that soon. I think also tomorrow we have a tomorrow's Thursday, right? I'm trying to think of the day. CWIL is hosting a community service learning webinar just on this topic specifically to learn from each other, so we can share those learnings as well. So it is happening across the country, and those are some of the resources we could share.
Great, thanks, Kara. Anyone else want to comment on supporting faculty? Francisca?
Just briefly, we've been looking a lot at supporting students from remote placements and focused on well-being, and have created a resource, and just go on our ASIN website, there are the resources there. But it's basically supporting people to be bold and go out there and make up new ways of working.
Great. Anyone else, or shall I move to the next question?
I think we could also add, Francisca, that on the ASIN website, the number of recordings of webinars with people giving examples of how they've transitioned their program, their faculty or academic staff, as we call them, have showcased how they've transitioned their programs to online. So if they go to the ASIN website, I think there is a few webinars there that have got people showcasing very specific examples.
In particular, there was a combined NZACE, now Will New Zealand, ASIN webinar that came up with a whole range of different virtual and online opportunities for Will, and some really good guidelines about when you set up a Will program in that virtual space, what it should look like and some of the to-dos and not to-dos. So that's on the ASIN and NZ and Will NZ websites, links to that webinar. And we must actually acknowledge that New Zealand and Australia have been working really, really closely together and combining our webinars instead of us all just sitting there in our own little silos. And it's been great sharing across the two countries. And I think Canadians have been joining in some of the webinars as well. So thanks for collaboration, ASIN.
Good. Okay, the second question was about facilitating, and there was a bit of a conversation about it, but I don't know if anyone wants to add to facilitating global interdisciplinary inter-university projects or anything. I mean, there was some people commented this was a good idea. Any ideas on how to do it? Would someone like to start?
In the coffee chats, in the ASIN coffee chats, this came up, Nora, and was suggested, and we were saying what is needed is somebody to lead it, to pull all the strings. And we're looking for that leadership and then to draw up and learn from it how to manage such a complex project and how can students can get that experience for credit and who assesses it or how does it all work and how to get employers around the globe included. It's a little bit of a logistics that needs to be thought through. But if people are interested, I'm very happy to hear from you. I can put my email in the chat and then we can take it from there.
Sounds good. Excellent. Any other comments on that, or I'll go to question three. Okay, so question three, with respect to equity issues, how are people supporting or approaching equal access for students and supports for students through an equity lens? Any comments on that during this time in particular, I'm assuming? Jenny, did you want to comment?
Yes, so equity and access, particularly to being able to work remotely in placement organisations and to work with online learning, is a big issue for many of our communities in New Zealand. And so the universities themselves took a really positive move and have provided internet packages, laptops either on loan or on rent to buys, and ways to ensure that students were given some opportunities to gain the resources that they needed to be able to work remotely or to study remotely, and it primarily was around studying remotely. So I think that helped in many of the communities to be able to do remote Will, if that was possible, depending on the nature of their discipline and what they were around. So they were good initiatives, but I don't think that would happen everywhere in the world. And so I think in New Zealand, we were pretty lucky the government was very much behind that here in New Zealand. It happened in the primary school sector as well. Schools were given money to enable internet connections and devices out to children learning at home. So I think we have got a really supportive government from that perspective.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jenny. Any other comments on equity and access?
I can say that we were fortunate to have at my college, we're part of a state grant for a workforce equity initiative. And so same, we were able to use the funds and quickly move. The state was very flexible with us on the use of the funds. And so we were able to supply our students with laptops, mobile computer labs. There were transportation issues that were all worked out. And so there's state funds that help support these initiatives within the colleges.
Great, thank you very much, Dawn. Kara, was your hand up? Yeah.
Yeah, so I just will give an example. Some of the resources we just shared around the virtual career fairs, which was built on some of the expertise we've had around the institutions that have been doing it for a while. One of the considerations is when you're looking at using the virtual tools is how do you make sure that it's accessible for anybody that has perhaps a disability that might create a barrier for them to participate. So the person actually developed the resources also has a disability, so really has that lens from it. So I think that it was really well done, and also made us think about how when you're moving things online, it's not even just the access to online, which itself is an issue, but how do you remove barriers or look at universal design. So those are some of the lenses as we build resources. And then in Canada, I think the other piece is that we have everything that we do, I'll switch for a second, is in being both in both official languages for access to our resources in both official languages. So that was something I think COVID really sped us up on, that anything we put out there, even if we put it out in one language first, we're making sure that it's accessible to the entire country. So from a couple different lenses, but definitely a challenge, and we continue to hear that it's a challenge. Some of the advocacy that we've been doing with other associations include student groups, and they've really echoed this, that the equitability and access continues to be an issue that we need to advocate together on.
Great, thanks very much, Kara. And I'm going to move on to the next question. Jenny, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, just adding to that. Obviously, online is where we sort of focus that conversation. But there's some other issues around equity and access, and it relates not necessarily to the online learning environment, but to the discipline environment. And there's some disciplines that are really, really severely affected through the business closing, the whole business structure is changing. And so that's an equity. We've got some students in certain disciplines that they can return in business as usual, but there's a whole range of disciplines, particularly, again, I relate to the New Zealand case, hospitality and tourism in New Zealand, absolutely decimated. So that's an equity and access issue that is completely independent of online learning. Yeah. Just raising that. Yeah.
Great. Okay, thank you. Let's move on to a question with respect to employers now. How are people with, and not using examples of funding support to encourage employers, but other examples, how are people encouraging employers to still engage with work integrated learning and taking students on? What strategies are people using to convince employers? And of course, there are some that just aren't able, as you mentioned, Jenny, but there are others that are. Any comments on that from the panel? Francisca?
I think in the first instance is to contact them and then to listen to them and really acknowledge their anxieties, their stress, the economic uncertainty, some are at the brink of collapse and all of that. And then from that listening, find out what they would need, what support they would need to take on a student. And rather than just say, here's a resource, how to supervise students, read it and do it. It's a personal relationship and partnership building, I think, that is important in this area. And at the same time, also supporting the student so that the partnership really works.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all about relationships, isn't it? So the stronger those relationships were to begin with, then those are the ones you build on. Thanks, Francisca. Dawn, would you like to say something?
Yes, I really agree with this. The employer relations, you really have to shift back. We had, when we had our recession, 08, 09, then you developed these types of skills that were relations abilities. And we've moved away from that because the demand has been so high for our students. That you've been able just to kind of throw out some emails and market, and the employers would sign up for the career fairs and here you go. But I've been talking to a lot of colleagues about the old strategies that we used to use in 09-10, and it's all kind of coming back. And so the high touch, pick up the phone, make the call, build the relationship, work with your alumni, and partner with them on completing the hours and tasks that are needed for this position. So that was one of the things that we found we had to do. They were really leery about taking on a remote work opportunity. And so we had to offer to help supervise the students in some of these cases. We had to offer to try to develop some work assignments for them. So that was where we got into, you know, building these additional online, free online courses that they would take to try to develop skills. And so we had to really partner with them to get our students through the spring semester. And I have a feeling that this is going to be going on for a long time. A lot of the employers have delayed summer, fall placements, and then our full-time students, our graduates, our seniors that had job offers secured 9 months ago for a June start are now being told Jan 4. So everything in Chicago, especially shutting down, the employees are not going to be starting until January 4th for these new hires. And so, you know, working with the employers to as best you can to keep these placements going. But we found we had to do a lot of hard work on the side to help make it happen.
Great. So we have 2 minutes left. Judy, do we have time for one more comment from Jenny, or do you want to make closing remarks?
I do want a minute. So if Jenny can do it in 60 seconds, that'd be great.
Yeah, just changing expectations, and perhaps where you potentially had will placements in paid businesses, you know, commercial profit-making businesses, considering the not-for-profit sector and the unpaid placements as opportunities for students to develop graduate capabilities, but in organisations that really need the help from a labour market perspective.
Great. Thank you. Well, I'm going to hand it over to Judy now, but thank you very much for answering the questions and for the thoughtful questions that were posed.
Yeah, well, thank you, everyone. And thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you very much to the very stimulating conversation. I've noticed that in the chat, people have been very generous and offered comments and suggestions and resources. Thank you very much for that. So I think what we've had is a stimulating conversation. And I think what we come out of it with is that we've been through a very difficult period, but we've got an opportunity with the creativity and innovation and some of the things that are emerging from this period, and perhaps some of the similarities and some of the things we're doing in our own countries we can bring to bear in each other's countries. And so we can work collectively to try to increase work integrated learning globally and see it really as an avenue to really prepare students, as we know, for a future that's very unpredictable. So before I close, I just want to say to you that you'll be getting an email from me that will include a survey, and we'd really like you to complete that. It's about this webinar, but also about what else WASE can do to support you in your country, in your practice. I'll give you links to the various associations that have been featured today. So thank you very much. We really appreciated your attendance. It was great to see everybody together working on work integrated learning. So thank you very much for joining us.